Chapter 12. Looking back, almost certainly, that was when it happened. The engine purred as it bore him back toward what Granger called civilization. Inside the cabin, the atmosphere was cool and filtered. Outside, the landscape had been abruptly transformed. For hundreds of hours, it had been the ground beneath his feet. A changeless environment for his daily routine, rock solid under slowly evolving skies, familiar in every detail. Now, it was insubstantial. A display of images flickering past tinted glass. The sun had slipped out of sight, hidden by the roof. Peter leaned his face near to the window and tried to look back, to capture a glimpse of the settlement. It was already gone. Granger drove with her usual careless competence, but seemed preoccupied, irritable. As well as keeping the steering wheel steady, she tapped keys on the dashboard and made numbers and symbols dance on an emerald green screen. She rubbed at her eyes, blinked hard, and evidently deciding that there was too much air blowing onto her contact lenses, adjusted the aircon settings. How strange it was to be inside a machine again. All his life he'd been inside machines, whether he realized it or not. Modern houses were machines. Shopping centers were machines. Schools, cars, trains, cities. They were all sophisticated technological constructs, wired up with lights and motors. You switched them on and didn't spare them a thought while they pampered you with unnatural services.
"Looks like you're the king of Freaktown," Granger remarked breezily.
Then, before he could take her to task for boorish disrespect, as some of my USIC colleagues would no doubt put it, "We're working together," said Peter. "The Oasens and I."
"Sounds cozy. But they're doing exactly what you want, right?"
He looked across at her. She had her eyes fixed on the terrain ahead. He half expected her to be chewing gum. It would have matched her tone. "They want to learn more about God," he said. "So we're building a church. Of course, it's not essential to have a physical place. You can worship God anywhere. But a church provides a focus."
"A signal that you mean business, huh?"
Again, he looked across at her, this time staring hard until she acknowledged him with a sideways glance. "Granger," he said, "why do I get the feeling our roles are reversed here? In this conversation, I mean. You're the employee of a giant corporation establishing a colony here. I'm the lefty pastor, the one who's supposed to be concerned about whether the little guys are being exploited."
"Okay, I'll try to be more stereotypical," she said lightly. "Maybe a coffee will do it."
She fetched a thermos up from the floor and balanced it next to her thigh. With her left hand on the steering wheel, she attempted with her right hand to unscrew the firmly sealed cap. Her wrist trembled.
"Let me do that for you."
She handed it over. He unscrewed the cup and poured her a coffee. The oily brown liquid was no longer hot enough to give off steam.
"Here."
"Thanks," she said, and took a sip.
"This tastes like shit."
He laughed. Granger's face looked odd to him when he saw it up close. Beautiful yet unreal, like a plastic doll's head mold. Her lips were too perfect, her skin too pale. But maybe it was the golden sunrise thing all over again. Maybe he had already, in the last 368 hours, adjusted to the way Oasens looked, and begun to accept their faces as the norm. Granger didn't fit.
"Hey, I just thought of something," he said.
"The drugs you give the Oasens are requisitioned especially for them, right?"
"Right.
But from what you were saying back there when you were talking to Jesus Lover One..."
"Jesus what?"
"Jesus Lover One, that's his name."
"The name you've given him?"
"No, the name he's given himself."
"Oh, okay."
Her face was impassive, with perhaps just the hint of a smirk. He couldn't tell if she disapproved of him deeply or thought the whole thing was just ridiculous. "Anyway," he pressed on, "when you were talking about diabetes, I got the impression the Oasens don't even know what diabetes is. So why offer them insulin?" Granger finished her coffee and screwed the cup back onto the thermos.
"I guess I didn't want it to go to waste," she said.
"The insulin wasn't meant for them.
It was our own supply, but we don't need it anymore. She paused for a couple of beats. Severin died.
Severin? The guy I traveled with?
Yup.
He's a diabetic.
Was. Peter tried to recall the journey he'd shared with Severin. It felt like something that had happened in another phase of his life, much longer ago than a few weeks.
When did he die?
Last night. That phrase doesn't mean much here, I know. Toward the end of the night. She consulted her watch. About 18 hours ago. Another couple of beats pause. You're conducting the funeral service. If you're willing, that is. Again, Peter tried to cast his mind back to the time he'd shared with Severin. He recalled BG asking Severin what religion he was, and Severin replying,
I'm nothing, and that's the way it's staying.
Severin might not have wanted a funeral service. He didn't have a religion. A lot of people here don't have a religion. But the thing is, we cannot throw a dead person into an incinerator without giving him some kind of a send-off. Peter pondered this a moment.
Can you, give me a rough idea of what sort of send-off the majority of the personnel might consider?
Totally up to you. We've got some Catholics, we've got some Baptists, we've got some Buddhists. You name it, we've got some. I wouldn't sweat about that. You were chosen because, well, let's just say that if you were a strict Pentecostal or a strict anything, you wouldn't be here. Somebody studied your resume and made a judgment that you can handle it. Handle funerals. Handle whatever. She clenched her fists on the steering wheel, drew a deep breath.
Whatever.
Peter sat in silence for a while. The landscape continued to flicker by. A rich, fragrant smell of white flower in various forms began to suffuse the cabin, seeping in from the back. Dear Peter, wrote B, we are in big trouble. He was sitting in his quarters, still unwashed and naked. Goose pimples prickled on his flesh. Big trouble. His wife's words had been sent a fortnight ago, or 12 days to be precise. She had kept silent for the first 48 hours of his stay among the Oasens, evidently counseling herself that anything she wrote would go unread until his return. But after 2 days, she'd written regardless, and written again the next day, and the next. She'd written 11 more messages, all of them now stored in glowing capsules at the bottom of his screen. Each capsule bore a number, the date of transmission. To his wife, these messages were already history. To him, they were a frozen present, yet to be experienced. His head buzzed with the urgent need to open them all, to crack open those capsules with 11 rapid-fire jabs of his finger, and buzzed also with the knowledge that he could only take them in one at a time. He could have started reading them an hour earlier in the vehicle on the way back from the settlement. But Granger's odd mood during the drive had discouraged him from asking her to tell him when they were close enough to the USIC base for the chute to work. Although he wasn't usually secretive or prone to embarrassment, he'd felt self-conscious at the prospect of reading his wife's personal communications right next to Granger. What if B made some unguardedly intimate reference? A gesture of sexual affection? No, it was better to restrain his eagerness and wait until he had privacy. On entering his USIC apartment, he'd stripped off his clothes, determined to shower before he tackled anything else. These last couple of weeks, working with the Oasens and sleeping out in the open, he'd become inured to sweat and dust. But his journey back to base in the air-conditioned vehicle had awakened his awareness of the muck that clung to him. It was a feeling he remembered well from his homeless years. Being invited into somebody's immaculate home and perching on the edge of their pale velour sofa, self-conscious about tainting it with his grimy arse. So, as soon as he stepped into his apartment, he decided that while the chute was warming up, doing its routine checks of its electronic innards, he could have a quick wash. Unexpectedly, however, Beatrice's messages loaded in at once. Their sudden arrival was a potent presence in the room, forcing him to sit down, dirty as he was. We are in big trouble, B said.
I don't want to worry you when you're so far away and there's nothing you can do. But things are falling apart fast. I don't mean you and me, of course, darling. I mean things in general. The whole country, probably. In our local supermarket, there are apology stickers on most of the shelves. Empty spaces everywhere. Yesterday, there was no fresh milk and no fresh bread. Today, all the UHT milk, flavoured milk, condensed milk, even coffee whitener has gone. Likewise, all the muffins, bagels, scones, chapatis, etc., etc. I overheard two people in the checkout queue having a testy discussion about how many cartons of custard one person should be allowed to buy. The term moral responsibility was used. The news says that the supply problems are due to chaos on the motorways because of the earthquake in Bedworth a few days back. That makes a kind of sense, judging by the footage. You know the way the top of a cake bursts open when it's risen dramatically in the oven? Well, a long stretch of the M6 looks like that. Of course, the other roads are jammed solid now, trying to accommodate the diverted traffic. But on the other hand, you would think there must be lots of bakeries and dairies located south of the quake site. I mean, surely we're not dependent on a truck coming down the M6 all the way from Birmingham to bring us a loaf of bread. I suspect what we're seeing here is sheer inflexibility in the way supermarkets operate. I bet they just aren't equipped to negotiate with a different bunch of suppliers at such short notice. If the market was allowed to respond more organically, no pun intended, to an event like this, I'm sure that bakeries and dairies in Southampton or wherever would be delighted to step into the breach. Anyway, the Bedworth quake is not the full story, regardless of what the news says. Food supplies have been erratic for ages, and the weather just gets weirder and weirder. We've had sunshine and mild conditions here. The carpets have finally dried out, thank goodness. But there have been freak hailstorms in other places, so bad that a couple of people have been killed. Killed by hailstones. It's been a good week for the news networks, I must say. The footage of the quake, the hailstorms, and, stand by folks, a spectacular riot in central London. It started as a peaceful protest against the military action in China, and ended with cars being set alight, mass brawling, baton charges, the whole shebang. Even the cleaning up afterward made for good pictures. There was fake blood, red paint, dripping off the stone lions in Trafalgar Square, and real blood splattered on the ground. The cameramen must have been peeing themselves with delight. Sorry to sound cynical, but the media gets so energised by this sort of thing. Nobody ever seems sad about it. There's no moral dimension. It's just the latest action-packed event. And while these photogenic calamities are flashed past, ordinary people get on with their lives, just doing their best to come to terms with everyday unhappiness. Anyway, I shouldn't try so hard to understand the big picture. Only God understands that, and He's in control. I have my life to lead, work to go to. It's early morning here. Beautiful light. Chilly, with Joshua perched on top of the filing cabinet snoozing in a sunbeam. My shift doesn't start till 2:30, so I'm going to do some chores and cook tonight's dinner, so that when I come home from work I can just tuck in, instead of eating peanut butter on toast like I usually do. I should eat some breakfast now to boost my energy, but there's nothing in the house I fancy. The plight of a serial addict in withdrawal. I'm sipping stale jasmine tea, left over from when we had Ludmilla staying with us, because normal tea without milk tastes wrong to me. Too much compromise. Okay, back again. I just went to the front door to pick up the mail. Nice postcard from some people in Hastings thanking us for our kindness. Can't think what kindness they're referring to, but they invite us to visit them. Could be difficult for you right now. Also, a letter from Sheila Frame. Remember her? She's the mother of Rachel and Billy, the kids who made our Noah's Ark wall hanging slash collage. Rachel is 12 now and doing okay, says Sheila, whatever okay means. And Billy is 14 and seriously depressed. That's why Sheila is writing to us. Her letter doesn't make much sense. She must have written it when she was stressed out. She keeps mentioning the snow leopard, assuming we must know all about the snow leopard. I've tried to phone, but she's at work, and by the time I get home tonight, it'll be 11:30 at least. I might try to phone from the ward during my meal break. Enough about my routine and uneventful life without my dear husband. Please tell me what's been happening with you. I wish I could see your face. I don't understand why the technology that allows us to communicate with each other like this can't stretch to sending a few pictures as well. But I suppose that's being greedy. It's miraculous enough that we can read each other's words at such a mind-boggling distance. Assuming you can still read them, of course. Please write soon to let me know you're all right. I feel I ought to have more specific questions and comments about your mission, but to be frank, you haven't told me very much about it. You're more of a speaker than a writer, I know that. There have been times I've sat in the congregation when you've preached, and I see you glancing down at your notes, the same notes I've seen you scribbling the night before, and I'm aware that on that little scrap of paper, there's just a few disjointed phrases. And yet this wonderful, eloquent, coherent speech comes out. A beautifully formed story that keeps everyone spellbound for an hour. I admire you so much at those times, my darling. I wish I could hear what you're saying to your new flock. I don't suppose you're writing any of it down afterward, or keeping a record of what they're saying to you. I don't feel I know these people at all. It's frustrating. Are you learning a new language? I suppose you must be. Love, B. Peter rubbed his face, and the sweaty, oily dirt accumulated into dark, seed-like particles in the palms of his hands. Reading his wife's letter had made him agitated and confused. He hadn't felt that way until now. For the duration of his stay with the Oasens, he'd been calm and emotionally stable, just getting on with the job. If he'd been occasionally bewildered, it was a happy sort of bewilderment. Now he felt out of his depth. There was a tightness squeezing his chest. He moved the chute's cursor to the next capsule in chronological sequence and opened a message that Beatrice had sent him a mere 20 hours after the last. It must have been the middle of her night. "I miss you," she wrote. "Oh, how I miss you. I didn't know it would feel like this. I thought the time would fly and you would be back. If I could just hold you once, just hug you tight for a few minutes, I could cope with your absence again. Even 10 seconds would do it. 10 seconds with my arms around you. Then I could sleep." And next day. "Horrible, ghastly things in the news. I can't bear to read, can't bear to look. Almost took the day off work today. Sat weeping in the toilets at break time. You are so far away, so incredibly far away, further away than any man has ever been from his woman. The sheer distance makes me ill. I don't know what's wrong with me. Forgive me for spilling my guts like this. I know it can't be helping you do whatever you're doing. Oh, how I wish you could be in touch now. Touching me, holding me, kissing me." The words hit him hard. They were the sort of thing he'd wanted to receive from her, but now that he received them, they caused him distress. A fortnight ago, he had missed her sexually and craved confirmation that she felt the same. She'd assured him that she missed him, that she wanted to hold him, sure. But the overall tone of her letters was sensible, preoccupied, as though his presence was a luxury rather than a necessity. She'd seemed so self-reliant. He'd wondered if he was indulging in a testosterone-fueled self-pity, or if that's how she saw it. Once he'd taken his place among the Oasens, this insecurity had evaporated. He didn't have time for it. And, trusting in the easy mutuality that he and B had always enjoyed, he'd assumed, if he thought about it at all, that B was in the same state of mind, that she was simply getting on with the daily business of life, that her love for him was like the color of her eyes, constantly there, but not in any way an impediment to useful activity. Instead, while he'd been laying the stones of his church and dozing happy in his hammock, she was in pain. His fingers hung suspended over the keyboard, poised to respond to her. But how could he, when she'd written 9 more messages to him, in hours and days that were already gone from her, but of which he knew nothing? He opened another capsule. "Dear Peter, please don't worry about me. I've got a grip now. I don't know why I went off the deep end like that. Too little sleep? The atmosphere has been oppressive these last few weeks. Yes, I know I said it was beautiful weather here, and that's true, in the sense that it's warm and sunny. But at night it's close, and rather hard to breathe.
a large chunk of North Korea was wiped out a few days ago. Not by a nuclear strike or even a nuclear accident, but by a cyclone called Toraji. It came off the Sea of Japan and swept inland like a ceremonial sword. I didn't make that simile up, obviously. Tens of thousands dead. Probably more than 1 million homeless. The government denied the severity of the damage at first, so all we had was satellite pictures. It was surreal. Here's this woman in a tailored yellow outfit, with immaculate hair and manicured nails, standing in front of this giant projected image, pointing at the various smudges and blobs, interpreting what they mean. You got the message that there were lots of wrecked houses and dead bodies in there somewhere. But all you could see was these beautifully buffed hands gesturing over what looked like an abstract painting. Then the government let some South Korean and Chinese aid workers in, and the proper video footage started coming through. Peter, I've seen things I wish I hadn't seen. Maybe that's why I got so frantic about missing you. Of course, I love you and miss you and need you, but I also needed to see these things with you, or else be spared from seeing them at all. I saw a huge concrete enclosure, like a giant pig kennel, whatever you call the enclosures where they farm pigs. The roof of it just peeping out of a huge lake of slimy water. A team of men were hacking at the roof with pickaxes, not achieving much. Then they blew a hole in it with explosives. A weird mixture of soupy stuff gurgled out of the hole. It was people. People and water. Half blended, like, I don't want to describe it. I will never forget it. Why do we get shown these things? Why, when we can't help? Later, I saw villagers using dead bodies as sandbags. Rescue workers with candles strapped to their heads, the candle fat running down their cheeks. How can such things be possible in the 21st century? I'm watching a high-resolution video clip that was recorded with a micro camera hidden in somebody's hat brim or whatever. And yet the technology of life-saving is straight from the Stone Age. I want to write more, even though I don't want to remember. I wish I could send you the images, even though I also wish I could erase them from my mind. Is it the lowest form of selfishness to want to share the burden like this? And what is my burden exactly? Sitting on my sofa in England, eating licorice all sorts, watching foreign corpses swirling around in muddy whirlpools, foreign children queuing for a scrap of tarpaulin. Someone at work said to me this morning, "Where is God in all this?" I didn't rise to the bait. I can never understand why people ask that question. The real question for the bystanders of tragedy is, where are we in all this? I've always tried to come up with answers to that challenge. I don't know if I can at the moment. Pray for me. Love, B. Peter clasped his hands. They were tacky with grime. New sweat on old sweat. He stood up and walked to the shower cubicle. His erection nodded comically with each step. He positioned himself under the metal nozzle and switched on the water, letting it douse his upturned face first. His scalp stung as the stream penetrated his matted hair, finding little scratches and scabs he hadn't realized were there. Stone cold at first, the water warmed up fast, dissolving the dirt off him, enfolding him in a cloud. He kept his eyes closed and let his face be bathed, almost scalded, under the pressurized spray. He cupped his testicles in his hands and, with his wrists, pressed his penis hard against his belly until the semen came. Then he soaped himself up from head to toes and washed thoroughly. The water that swirled around the plug hole was grey for longer than he would have thought possible. When he was clean, he continued to stand under the hot stream and might have remained there for half an hour or more if the water hadn't suddenly sputtered to a trickle. An LED display inside the shower dial flashed 000. He hadn't twigged the significance of the gauge until now. Of course. It made perfect sense that duration of water use should be limited by a built-in timer. It's just that USIC was an American corporation. And the idea of a frugal, resource-conscious American corporation almost defied belief. As soon as the drain stopped gurgling, he was able to discern that a noise he'd been aware of for a while, which he'd attributed to the pipes, was in fact someone knocking at the door. "Hi," said Granger when he opened it. Her eyes barely flickered at the sight of him standing there wet, clad only in a bath towel knotted around his waist. She had a dossier clutched to her bosom. "Sorry, I couldn't hear you," he said. "I knocked real loud," she said. "I suppose I expected there to be a doorbell or a buzzer or an intercom or something."
USIC isn't big on unnecessary technology.
"Yes, I've noticed that. It's one of the unexpectedly admirable things about you."
"Gee, thanks," said Granger. "You say the sweetest things."
Behind him, the chute emitted a soft noise, like an electronic sigh. The sound it made when its screen went dark to conserve power. He remembered North Korea. "Have you heard about North Korea?" he said.
"It's a country in, Asia," she said.
"There's been a terrible cyclone there. Tens of thousands of people are dead." Granger blinked hard, flinched almost. But a moment later, she'd regained her composure.
"That's tragic," she said.
"Nothing we can do about it, though." She held the dossier out to him. "Everything you always wanted to know about Arthur Severin, but were afraid to ask." He took the file. "Thank you. The funeral is in 3 hours."
"Right. How long is that in,
He gestured vaguely, hoping that a wave of his hand might convey the difference between time as he'd always known it and time here and now. She smiled, patient with his stupidity. 3 hours, she repeated, and raised her wrist to display her watch. 3 hours means 3 hours.
"I wasn't expecting quite so little notice," he said.
"Relax. Nobody's expecting you to write 50 pages of rhyming poetry in his honor. Just say a few words. Everyone understands you didn't know him too well. That kind of helps."
"The impersonal touch?"
"It's what the great religions offer, isn't it?" And she lifted her wristwatch again. "I'll come and collect you at 13:30.
She left without another word and shut the door behind her, at exactly the instant that his towel fell off.
"We are gathered here," said Peter to the hushed and solemn assembly, "to honor a man who, only one sunrise ago, was a living, breathing person, just like us." He cast a glance toward the coffin that sat on a rack of metal rollers in front of an incinerator. Instinctively, everyone else in the room looked at it too. The coffin was made of recycled cardboard with a lustrous gloss of vegetable glaze to give it that solid wood effect. The rack was just like the ones attached to X-ray machines at airports. "A person who drew air into his lungs," Peter continued. "Lungs that were a bit the worse for wear, perhaps, but still working fine, delivering oxygen to his blood. The same blood that's pumping in all of us as we stand here today." His voice was loud and clear without amplification, but lacked the reverb resonance it was granted in churches and assembly halls. The funeral room, while large, was acoustically cramped, and the furnace inside the incinerator generated a noise like a distant jet plane passing by.
"Listen to your heartbeat," said Peter. "Feel the ever so slight tremor inside your chest as your body miraculously keeps functioning. It's such a gentle tremor, such a quiet sound that we don't appreciate how much it matters. We may not have always been aware of it. We may scarcely have given it a thought from day to day. But we were sharing the world with Art Severin, and he was sharing it with us. Now the sun has come up on a new day, and Art Severin has changed. We are here today to face up to that change."
The mourners numbered 52. Peter wasn't sure how big a proportion of the total USIC staff this was. There were only 6 women, including Granger. The rest were males, making Peter wonder if Severin had failed to win the respect of his female colleagues, or whether this simply reflected the gender distribution of the base. Everyone was dressed in the clothes they might usually wear at work. Nobody wore black. BG and Tusker stood in the forefront of the crowd. Tusker, clad in a loose green military shirt, military camouflage trousers, and his trademark tennis shoes, was nevertheless almost unrecognizable, having shaved off his beard. BG was unmistakable as ever. The biggest body in the room, his facial hair maintained with scalpel fine precision. A white t-shirt clung to his musculature like paint. A wrinkled white surwile hung off his hips, its cuffs puddling over incongruous polished shoes. His arms were folded across his chest, his face composed and imperiously tolerant. A few people in the ranks behind him were looking more quizzical, nudged off balance by the eulogy's opening salvo.
"Arthur Lawrence Severin died young," said Peter. "But he lived many lives. He was born in Bend, Oregon, 48 years ago, to parents he never knew, and was adopted by Jim and Peggy Severin. They gave him a happy and active childhood, mostly in the open air. Jim repaired and maintained campsites, hunting lodges, and military outposts. Art could drive a tractor by the time he was 10, operate a chainsaw, shoot deer, all that dangerous stuff that kids shouldn't be allowed to do. He was all set to take over the family business. Then, his adoptive parents divorced, and Art started getting into trouble. His teenage years were spent in and out of juvenile corrective institutions and rehabilitation programs. By the time he was old enough to go to jail, he already had a long record of crack cocaine abuse and DUI offenses."
The mourners were not so blank-faced now. A thrill of unease was passing through them, a thrill of interest and anxiety. Heads tilted, brows knitted, lower lips folding under top ones. Faster breathing. Children drawn in by a story.
"Art Severin got time off for good behavior and was soon back on the streets of Oregon. But not for long. Frustrated at lack of employment opportunities in the U.S. for young ex-crims, he relocated to Sabah, Malaysia, where he started a tool supply business with some drug dealing on the side. It was in Sabah that he met Camelia, a local entrepreneur who supplied female companionship to the timber industry. They fell in love, married, and although Camelia was already in her 40s, produced two daughters, Nora and Pau Pei, always known as May. When Camelia's brothel was shut down by the authorities and Art's business was squeezed by competition, he found work in the timber trade. And it was only then that he first discovered his lifelong fascination with the mechanics and chemistry of soil erosion." With measured assurance, Peter began to walk toward the coffin. The hand in which he had been holding his Bible swung at his side, and everyone could see that his thumb was pressed against a small scrap of hand-scribbled paper inside the scripture. "Art Severin's next life was in Australia," he said, gazing down at the casket's lustrous surface. "Sponsored by a company that recognized his potential, he studied geotechnics and soil mechanics at the University of Sydney. He graduated in record time, this young man who dropped out of high school only 9 years before, and was soon being headhunted by engineering firms because of his deep understanding of soil behavior, and also because of his custom-made equipment. He could have made a fortune in patents, but he never saw himself as an inventor. Merely as a worker who, as he put it, got mad at crappy tools." There was a murmur of recognition in the crowd. Peter laid his free hand on the coffin lid, gently but firmly, as if laying it on Art Severin's shoulder. Whenever he found that the available apparatus couldn't deliver the quality of data he demanded, he simply designed and built technology that would. Among his inventions was... And here he consulted the scrap of paper inside his Bible. "A new sampling tool for use in cohesionless sands below groundwater level." Among his academic papers, again written by this man whose high school teachers considered him a hopeless delinquent, were undrained triaxial tests on saturated sands and their significance to a comprehensive theory of shear strength, achieving constant pressure control for the triaxial compression test, stability gain due to pore pressure dissipation in a soft clay foundation, overhauling Terzaghi's principle of effective stress, some suggested solutions to anomalies at low hydraulic gradients, and dozens more. Peter closed his Bible and hugged it to his abdomen, directly under the crucifix-shaped stain. His dish dusher had been laundered and pressed, but fresh sweat was already spreading in patches all over it. The assembled mourners were perspiring too. "Now, I'm not going to pretend that I have much of a clue what those titles mean,"
said Peter with a faint grin. Some of you will, others won't. The important thing is that Art Severin turned himself into a world-renowned expert on something more useful than taking drugs. Although, he didn't let his old skills lapse entirely. Before he worked for USIC, he used to smoke 50 cigarettes a day. A ripple of chuckles passed through the crowd. There had been a solitary, suppressed snort earlier on when he'd referred to the female companionship supplied by Camellia's business. But this laughter now was unashamed, relaxed. But we're getting ahead of the story, he cautioned. We're leaving out some of his lives. Because Art Severin's next life was as a consultant on major dam building projects in a dozen countries from Zaire to New Zealand. His time in Malaysia had taught him the value of staying out of the limelight, so he rarely took the credit for his achievements, preferring to let politicians and corporate heads bask in the glory. But glorious indeed were the dams he nurtured to completion. He was especially proud of the Aziz Dam in Pakistan, which, if you'll forgive an unintended pun, was truly groundbreaking. A rock-filled earth dam with an impervious clay core. The entire project required a high degree of attention to detail, since it was an earthquake fault zone. It still stands today. Peter raised his chin, looked out of the nearest window at the alien emptiness beyond. His congregation looked likewise. Whatever was out there symbolized achievement, hard-won achievement, within a vast environment that did not change unless dedicated professionals made it happen. A few eyes glinted with moisture. Art Severin's next life was not a happy one, said Peter, on the move again, as though inspired by Severin's own restlessness. Camellia left him, for reasons he never understood. Both his daughters were badly affected by the breakup. Nora turned against him, and May was diagnosed schizophrenic. A few months after a grueling and expensive divorce settlement, Art was investigated by tax authorities and billed for money he didn't have. Within a year, he was drinking heavily, on welfare, living in a motorhome with May, watching her get worse and getting sicker and sicker himself with undiagnosed diabetes. But here's where the story takes an unexpected direction, he said, turning abruptly, making eye contact with as many of his listeners as he could. May went off her medication, committed suicide, and everybody who'd been watching Art Severin's decline assumed he would completely hit the skids and be found dead one day in his trailer. Instead, he sorted out his health, tracked down his real father, borrowed some money, shipped himself back to Oregon, and found work as a tour guide. He did it for 10 years, refusing offers of promotion, refusing opportunities to get back into the geotechnics industry, until finally USIC came along. USIC made him an offer he couldn't refuse. The chance to test out, on a grand scale, his theories on the use of soils and soft rocks as engineering materials. That grand-scale testing ground, declared Peter, is here. It's what we are standing on today. Art Severin's skills helped to take this fantastically ambitious experiment as far as it has reached. And, because of Art's generous sharing of his expertise, his skills will live on in his colleagues, you who knew him. I've talked mostly about Art's past. A past many of you may have been scarcely aware of, because Art seldom spoke of it. He was, as I'm sure some of you would agree, a hard man to get to know. I won't pretend to have known him myself. He showed kindness to me on my journey here, but by the time we arrived, we'd exchanged some tense words. I was looking forward to catching up with him later after I'd settled into my own work here. I was looking forward to smoothing things over between us, but that's the way it goes with the dead and those they leave behind. Each of you will have your last memory of Art Severin. The last thing you said to him, the final thing he said to you. Maybe it's the smile you shared over some detail of your work together, a smile that will mean something more to you now. A symbol of a relationship that was in pretty good order, pretty much ready to be severed clean. Or maybe you'll remember a look he gave you, one of those what-the-hell-did-he-mean-by-that moments.
Something that makes you wonder whether there was anything you could do or should have done to make his absence now seem more natural. But either way, we're struggling to make sense of his unreachability. The fact that he's in a different dimension from us now. He's no longer breathing the same air, no longer the same sort of creature. We know there was more to him than the body that's stored in this casket. Just as we know that there's more to us than our kidneys and our intestines and our earwax. But we don't have accurate terminology for what that extra thing is. Some of us call it the soul. But what is that, really? Is there a research paper on it that we can read that would explain the properties of Art Severin's soul and tell us how it differs from the Art Severin we knew? The guy with the discolored teeth and prickly temperament. The guy who found it difficult to trust women. The guy who had a habit of drumming on his knees to rock music that played in his head. Peter had been walking forward slowly, getting closer to his congregation, until he stood within arm's reach of the front row. BG's forehead was contorted with wrinkles. His eyes shone with tears. The woman next to him was weeping. Tusker's jaw was set, his lopsided grin trembling slightly. Granger, somewhere in the back row, was bone pale, her expression softened by pain. People, you know I'm a Christian. For me, that all-important research paper is the Bible. For me, that vital missing data is Jesus Christ. But I know that some of you are of different faiths. And I know that Art Severin professed to have none. BG asked him what religion he was, and he said, I'm nothing. I never got a chance to discuss with him what he really meant by that. And now, I'll never get that chance. But it's not because Art Severin is lying here dead. No. It's because this body here isn't Art Severin. We all know that instinctively. Art Severin isn't here anymore. He's somewhere else, somewhere where we can't be. We're standing here, breathing air into those funny, spongy bladders we call lungs, our torsos shaking slightly from the pump action of that muscle we call a heart, our legs getting uncomfortable from balancing on our foot bones too long. We are souls shut inside a cage of bones, souls squeezed into a parcel of flesh. We get to hang around in there for a certain number of years, and then we go where souls go. I believe that's into the bosom of God. You may believe it's somewhere different, but one thing's for sure, it's somewhere and it's not here. Peter walked back to the coffin, laid his hand on it once again. I can't say for sure if Art Severin really truly believed he was nothing more than the contents of this coffin. If so, he was wrong. Maybe I shouldn't get into another argument with him now. Maybe it's in bad taste. But Art, forgive me. Forgive us. We've got to tell you. You weren't nothing. It wasn't true that you were going nowhere. You were traveling on the great human journey, and yesterday you broke through the final checkpoint, and you've reached the destination. You were a brave man who lived many lives, and each life required more courage than the last. And now you're in the next life, where your body won't let you down anymore, and you don't need insulin, and you don't crave nicotine, and nobody betrays your trust, and every mystery you racked your brains about is clear as day now, and every hurt you ever suffered is okay now, and you're feeling pity for us down here, still dragging our heavy bodies around. There was a grunt of surprise from the audience. BG had lifted his massive arm to wipe his eyes, and his elbow had accidentally bumped against someone's skull. Art Severin, proclaimed Peter, and despite the muffled acoustics of the room, there seemed somehow to be a churchy reverb after all. We are here today to dispose of your old cage of bones, your parcel of flesh. You don't need that stuff anymore. They are crappy tools. But if it's all right with you, please let us keep a few little souvenirs, our memories. We want to keep you with us, even as we let you go. We want you to live on in our minds, even though you're living somewhere bigger and better than that. One day, we too will go where souls go, where you have traveled before us. Until then, goodbye, Arthur Lawrence Severin. Goodbye.
Back in his own quarters, after he'd spent some time with a few of the mourners who hadn't wanted to leave, even after the coffin had been consumed, Peter seated himself once more in front of the chute. His clothing was sodden with sweat. He wondered how long the interval was between full water supplies to the shower. His head buzzed with the intimacies and confidences that USIC employees had just shared with him. Facts about their lives that he must store in his memory, names he must make sure not to forget. His wife's unopened capsules hung suspended on the screen. 9 more messages he hadn't had time to read until now.
Dear Peter, excuse what will probably be a short, garbled message. I'm tired out. Sheila Frame and the two kids, Rachel and Billy, were here all afternoon and most of the evening. For them it was the weekend, but I'd worked an early shift after a late shift the day before. Rachel is a handful. Still kind of sweet but full of borderline obsessive compulsive habits. Quite exhausting to watch. Hormones, I suppose. You wouldn't recognize her physically. Looks like a porn starlet slash pop star slash heiress party girl. The usual mix for pubescent females these days. Billy is painfully polite and shy. Small for his age and a bit chubby with it. Barely spoke the whole time he was here, and obviously undergoing agonies of embarrassment the more chatty slash nervy his mother became. Sheila smelled a little boozy, or maybe it was just very strong cologne, I don't know. She's buzzing with stress. The whole house is still full of it, even though they left an hour ago. How I wish that you and I could have tackled them together. One of us calming Sheila down, the other relating to the kids, maybe taking it in turns. I don't know why they stayed so long. I can't imagine I was much use to them. Billy's one and only moment of candor was when I parked him in front of my computer to play a game. He took one look at the Noah's Ark display and his whole face flinched like someone had hit him. He told me that the snow leopard is extinct. The last surviving specimen died in a zoo a few weeks back. The snow leopard was my favorite, he said. Then he sat down at the computer. Within about 30 seconds, he was lost in a realistic prison interior, shooting the guards' heads off, blowing doors open, getting killed. Must go to bed immediately. Up at 5:30 tomorrow morning. I drank some of the wine that Sheila brought, so she wouldn't be self-conscious about drinking alone. I will regret it when that alarm clock goes off. Please tell me a little more about how your mission is going. I want to talk specifics with you. It feels so strange not to. Peter, it hurts not to. I feel like I'm your sister or something, sending you a long screed of complaint, chattering about things you can't possibly care about. I'm still the same person you've known, the one you can always rely on to give you perspective and confirmation. I just need to have a clearer sense of what you're seeing and doing and experiencing, my darling. Give me some names, some particulars. I know you can't right now because you're at the settlement and there's no way to read this message. But when you get back, please, take some time out to reflect. Let me be there for you. Must go to bed now. Love, B. Peter rocked on the chair, overloaded with adrenaline, but also tired. He wasn't sure if he should, or even could, read Beatrice's other 8 messages without answering this one. It felt cruel. Perverse not to respond. As though B were calling out to him over and over and he was ignoring her cries. Dear B, he wrote on a fresh page. Today I conducted a funeral. Art Severin. I didn't know he was a diabetic. He died suddenly while I was away at the settlement. I was given a comprehensive file on his life and about 3 hours to prepare something. I did my best. Everyone seemed to appreciate it. Love, Peter. He stared at the words on the screen, aware that they needed expansion. Details, details. A woman called Manili had confessed to him that she hadn't given a thought to Christianity since she was a small child, but that she'd felt the presence of God today. He considered telling B that. His heart was thumping strangely. He left his message in draft form,
unsent, and opened another capsule. Dear Peter, are you sitting down? I hope so. Darling, I'm pregnant. I know you'll think that's not possible, but I stopped taking the pill a month before you left. Please don't be angry with me. I know we agreed to wait another couple of years, but please understand that I was scared you'd never come back. I was scared there'd be an explosion at the launch and your mission would be over before it began. Or that you'd disappear somewhere along the way, just disappear into space, and I would never even know what became of you. So, as the departure date got closer and closer, I got more and more desperate for some part of you to be here with me, no matter what. I prayed and prayed about it, but just didn't feel I got an answer. In the end, I left it in God's hands whether I would be fertile so soon coming off the pill. Of course, it was still my decision. I'm not denying that. I wish the decision had been ours together. Maybe it was, or could have been. Maybe if we'd discussed it, you would have said it was exactly what you'd been wanting to suggest yourself. But I was terrified you'd say no. Would you have? Just tell me straight. Don't spare me. Whatever you feel, I hope it makes some difference to you that I'm proud and thrilled to be carrying your baby. Our baby. By the time you come back, I'll be 26 weeks along the way and getting pretty enormous. That's assuming I don't have a miscarriage. I hope I don't. It wouldn't be the end of the world, and we could try again, but it would be a different child. This one I'm carrying feels so precious. Already. You know what I was thinking when you made love to me on the way to the airport? I was thinking, I'm ready. This is the moment. This is exactly the right moment. All it needs now is one tiny seed. And I bet that was when it happened. Looking back, almost certainly, that was when it happened. Chapter 13. The engine kindled into life.
And this is where it all started, said the woman solemnly. This is what it looked like in the beginning.
Peter nodded. He kept his jaw rigid and didn't dare try to make the appropriate interested noises, for fear of breaking into a grin or even laughing out loud. The official opening of this facility was a momentous occasion for everyone gathered here today.
We put an extra thick layer of epoxy on the top of the downstream surface, the woman continued, pointing to the relevant parts of the scale model, to control the migration of water through the foundation. These tubes on the downstream side were connected to pressure transducers.
If she'd been breezy or casual, it wouldn't be so bad, but she was deadly earnest, and that made it funnier. And everybody but him seemed to understand what she was talking about, which made it funnier still. Then there was the inherent comicality of an architectural scale model. So dignified, so full of symbolic importance, and yet so dinky. Like something from a children's playground. And, added to that, the shape of the model itself. Two inverted cups joined together, fully justifying the Big Brazier nickname. The real buildings, from a distance, hadn't struck him as particularly comical. He'd seen them, along with everyone else, looming on the horizon earlier in the afternoon, as USIC's convoy of vehicles drove across the scrubland, each vehicle ferrying half a dozen employees. The sheer size of the structures, and the fact that one partially obscured the other on approach, made them appear like nothing less than what they were. Mighty works of architecture. When the convoy finally cruised to a standstill in front of the foremost structure, the vehicles parked in an area of shade so large that its contours were difficult to tell. Only once Peter and the other USIC personnel were gathered together in the entrance hall, contemplating a replica barely a meter high, was the design of this place revealed in all its bulbous symmetry. The officiating woman, Hayes, an engineer who'd worked closely with Severin, waved her hand in the air over the twin structures, oblivious to the fact that she appeared to be miming a caress of a sofa-sized bosom.
The desired G-level. Self-weight displacements. Overtopping simulation.
Hayes droned on.
Uplift pressures with five transducers. Proximity probe.
Peter's urge to laugh had passed.
Now he could scarcely keep awake. The entrance hall was stiflingly warm and poorly ventilated. It felt rather like being enclosed inside an engine, which was basically what it was, of course. He swayed slightly on his feet, took a deep breath, and made an effort to stand straighter. Bubbles of trapped sweat squelched in his sandals. His eyes stung, and haze became blurry.
Recorded in real time.
He blinked. Haze muddled back into focus. She was a tiny woman with a military-style masculine haircut, and the sort of dress sense that made anything she wore look like a uniform, even when it wasn't. He'd made her acquaintance several days ago in the mess hall when she was shoveling her way through a plate of white flour mash and gravy. They'd conversed for 10-15 minutes, and she'd been perfectly pleasant in a dull sort of way. She was from Alaska, used to like dogs and sledding, but was content nowadays to read about them in magazines, and didn't believe in any religion. Although she kept kind of an open mind about poltergeists, having had a weird experience in an uncle's house when she was 12. Her low-pitched monotone was, he'd thought, mildly attractive, reminding him slightly of Bee's melodious croon. But when delivering a lecture on thermodynamics and dam design, it wasn't so scintillating. Even so, the fact that he was having trouble staying awake annoyed him. Boring experiences didn't normally affect him like this. Usually, he had an exceptional tolerance for tedium. Homelessness had taught him that. But living in the USIC base was worse than homelessness somehow. He'd been back a week, and his sunburned face had peeled and healed, but his brain wasn't recovering so well. He was wired and wakeful when he should be sleeping, and dopey when he should be alert. And here he was, nodding off, when he should be admiring the engineering genius of USIC's brand new centrifuge and power facility. Mutually exclusive functions. Couldn't be done. Severin. Vacuum net. The vision to let go of photovoltaics. It was impressive what had been wrought here. A feat of engineering that stretched the limits of what was thought possible. Under normal conditions, that is to say, the conditions everyone was used to back home, rain fell over a large area and accumulated in great pools, or flowed into rivers which moved across the landscape gathering speed. Either way, a substance which, to a person standing under a rain shower, was perceived as individual droplets falling through the air, was transformed by time and volume and momentum into a vast force that could power 100,000 engines. These principles did not apply on Oasis. The raindrops manifested, dropped onto the sponge-like terrain, and were gone. If you happened to be outdoors while it was raining and held out a cup, it would be filled. Or you could quench your thirst more simply than that, by leaning back with your mouth wide open. But when it was over, until the next rainfall. The big brassiere's grand bipartite structure defied these limitations. One part of it was designed to suck the rain from the sky, gather the diffused droplets into a cyclonic whirl, tug the condensed water into a gigantic centrifuge. But that was only half of the project's audacious ingenuity. The amount of electricity required to power this centrifuge was, of course, colossal, far beyond the yield of USIC's existing solar panels. So, the harvested water was not merely flung into a reservoir. It was first put to work in a giant boiler, where fearsome volumes of trapped steam set turbines spinning. Each of the two buildings fed into each other, providing the energy to catch the water, providing the water to generate the energy. It wasn't exactly a perpetual motion machine. 200 solar panels stationed in the scrubland all around the facility kept the sun's rays beaming in. But it was mind-bogglingly efficient. Oh, if only a few of these big braziers could be installed in famine-ravaged countries like Angola and Sudan. What a difference they would make. Surely USIC, having just achieved this technological marvel and proved what could be done, must be negotiating such projects. He would have to ask someone about that. But now is not the time. And in conclusion, Hayes was saying, one last practicality. We're cognizant of the fact that there's been some reluctance to use the official title of this facility, the Centrifuge and Power Facility. We're further cognizant of the fact that there's a nickname currently being usaged that is not what we want to hear. Some people may think it's funny, but it's not exactly dignified, and I think we owe it to Severin, who works so hard on this project along with the rest of us, to give it a name that we can all live with. So, in recognition of the fact that a lot of people prefer names that are short and snappy, here's the deal. Officially, we are here today to celebrate the opening of the USIC Centrifuge and Power Facility. Unofficially, we suggest you call it the Mother.
Because it's one big motherfucker, someone called out.
Because necessity is the mother of invention, Hayes explained patiently. With that, the opening ceremony speech more or less came to an end. The remainder of the visit was, or pretended to be, a guided tour of the facility to demonstrate how the principles established by the scale model were put into full-size practice. However, so many of the facility's important features and mechanisms were encased in concrete, or submerged in water, or accessible only by vertiginous steel ladders, that there was nothing much to see. Only when they were driving away back to the USIC base in their little convoy did Peter finally feel the surge of inspiration he hadn't been able to muster during Hayes's speech. Squashed between two strangers on the back seat of a steamy vehicle, he sensed the world darkening a little. He craned round and wiped the condensation off the rear window with his sleeve. The great power utility was already receding in the distance, shimmering slightly in the haze of spent fuel coming out of the Jeep's exhaust. But what could be seen more clearly now was the multitude of solar panels, heliostats, that were arranged in a far-flung semicircle on the landscape all around the mother. Each of them was meant to catch the sunlight and redirect it straight to the power station. But by coincidence, the sun was partially obscured by passing clouds. The heliostats swiveled on their podiums, adjusting the angle of their mirrored surfaces, adjusting, adjusting, adjusting again. They were only rectangular slabs of steel and glass, not in the least human-looking. But still, Peter was moved by their insensate confusion. Like all creatures in the universe, they were only waiting for the elusive light that would grant them purpose. Back in his quarters, Peter checked for messages on the chute. He felt guilty checking for fresh communications from B when he'd let so much time lapse since writing one himself. In his last letter, it reassured her that he was delighted to hear she was pregnant and that no, of course he wasn't angry with her. The rest of the letter was padded out with mission-related stuff he couldn't recall. The entire letter had been maybe 15 lines long, 20 at most, and had taken him several hours of sweat to produce. It was true he felt no anger, but he felt disturbingly little of anything else either, aside from stress at his inability to respond. It was difficult in his current circumstances to grab hold of feelings and brand them with a name. If he tried his hardest, he could just about make sense of what was happening on Oasis. But that was because he and the events he was grappling with were in the same space. His mind and heart were trapped in his body, and his body was here. The news of B's pregnancy was like news of some momentous event in Britain's current affairs. He knew it was important, but he had no idea what he could or should do about it. He assumed that any other man would be imagining the intimate realities of being a father. The baby in his arms, the corporeal son or daughter bouncing on his knee, the kid's high school graduation or whatever. He could imagine such scenes only in the most contrived and generic way, as if they were two-dimensional panels in a comic book written and drawn by shameless hacks. Trying to visualize B with a baby inside her was impossible. There was no baby yet. And if he tried to conjure up a vision of her belly, his mind's eye played him old footage of her slim abdomen inside the t-shirt she wore to bed. Or, if he tried harder, an x-ray of a pelvis that could have been anyone's, speckled with cryptic lucencies that could be a grub-like embryo, could be gas, could be cancer. "You must be extra careful now to take care of yourself," he'd written. His use of care twice in one short sentence was not ideal. But it had taken him long enough to come up with the words, and he meant them, so he'd sent them. Sincere as the sentiment was, though, he had to admit it was the sort of thing an auntie or a brother might say.
And since then, he'd not yet managed to write her another letter, despite receiving several from her. More than once, he'd forced himself to sit down and begin, but had got stuck after Dear B and taken it no further. Today, he tried to convince himself to type a few words about his visit to the Big Brazier, but he doubted that his wife was hanging out for information on this topic. There was nothing new from her today, which was unusual. He hoped nothing bad had happened. To Beatrice, that is. Bad things were happening to the world in general all the time, it seemed. Of course, the world had always been crowded with mishaps and disasters, just as it had also been graced with fine achievements and beautiful endeavors, which the media tended to ignore, if only because honor and contentment were hard to capture on film. But even allowing for all that, Peter felt that the dispatches he was getting from Beatrice were alarmingly crammed with bad news. More bad news than he knew what to do with. There was only so much calamitous change you could hear about. Events that rewrote what you thought was general knowledge before your brain stopped digesting and you clung on to older realities. He accepted that Mira had gone back to her husband and that an American politician's wife had been shot dead in her swimming pool. He remembered that there was a little girl in Oskaloosa called Coretta who'd lost her father. He accepted with some difficulty that the Maldives had been wiped out by a tidal wave. But when he thought of North Korea, he pictured a calm cityscape of totalitarian architecture, with legions of bicycle-riding citizens going about their normal business. There was no room in the picture for a catastrophic cyclone. No fresh disasters today, though. No news is good news, as some people might say. Uncomforted, he retrieved one of B's older letters and reread it. Dear Peter, I got your message last night. I'm so relieved that you're not angry with me, unless the shortness of what you wrote indicates that you are angry, but just keeping it under control. But I don't think so. You must be unbelievably preoccupied with your mission, learning the language and tackling all sorts of challenges that no one has ever faced before. Please tell me a little more about those when you have a minute. From what you have said, it sounds like you're adjusting to the weather at least. That's not really possible here because it's gone haywire again. More torrential rainfall, with the occasional gale force wind as a bonus. The house smells of damp. Mildew on the furniture and walls. Opening the windows lets in fresh air, but also rain. It's hard to know what to do. I know it's very wet where you are too, but from the little you told me about how the Oasins live, the place seems designed for it. Here in England, everything is set up on the basis that the weather will stay mostly dry and moderate. We're just not very good at planning for emergencies. Denial, I suppose. Heard from Sheila again. Billy is clinically depressed, she says. Not good in a 14-year-old boy. I arranged to take him out somewhere on the day that the family is scheduled to move house. Did I mention that Sheila and Mark split up? Neither one of them could meet the mortgage repayments alone, so they've decided to sell up and move into flats. Actually, Mark is going to Romania. I'm not convinced it's wise to move house without letting your kids be part of the process. But Sheila says Billy genuinely doesn't want to know, and it's better if he just gets delivered to the flat when it's a fait accompli. She's given me money to take him to a movie, but I'm actually going to take him to a cat show, which happens to be on at the Sports and Leisure Centre on that day. It's risky, because A, he may be the sort of kid who gets freaked out at animals being kept in small cages, and B, it will remind him of the snow leopard. But I hope that seeing all those different cats gathered together in one place will reassure him somehow. Phew! If you could have heard the crash that just reverberated through the house! It almost gave me a heart attack. The window of the bathroom is shattered, hundreds of glass shards in the bathtub and on the floor. I thought it was vandalism at first, but it was the wind. A big gust ripped an apple off the tree in the backyard and flung it against our window. But fear not. Someone from the church is coming to fix it ASAP within 2 hours, he said. Graham Stone. Remember him? His wife died of cirrhosis. I went to the supermarket yesterday. It was closed. No explanation, just a sellotape piece of paper saying it wouldn't be open until further notice. Quite a lot of people outside. Would-be customers peering through the glass.
Inside, the lights were on. Everything looked as normal, the shelves stocked up. A couple of security guys stationed near the doors. A few staff, walking around the aisles, talking calmly, as though nobody could see them. As though they were in their own living room instead of on public display in the high street. Weird. I stood there for about 5 minutes, I don't know why. Eventually, a cheeky young West Indian man called through the glass to one of the security guys, saying, "Can I have a packet of 20 Benson and Hedges, mate?" No response, so he adds, "It's for me mum, mate." A ripple of laughter went through the crowd. It was one of those communal things, when something small and funny happens that everyone gets, and for just an instant everyone's united. I love those moments. Anyway, it was obviously downhill from there, so I walked to the 24-hour convenience store and tried to score some milk there, but no joy. "What are you eating, my darling? Anything I would fancy a bite of?"